Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Ewlings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Ewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding to working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Ryan Brown. Ryan is an artist who works in the naturalist tradition, studying figures, still life, and landscapes. He's dedicated himself to the methods practiced by the masters of Western European art and has established the Center for Academic Study and Naturalist Painting in Utah to continue this tradition. Ryan, welcome to the show. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself and what you do for a living?
Like you said, I'm a painter in the naturalist tradition. I try to emulate the quality of late 19th century painting. I studied in the traditions that come from 19th century Paris academies and ateliers, and try to paint nature as I observe it.
Now, what is it exactly about the traditional methods of Western European masters that appeals to you?
I think there's something for me that I really respond to in terms of human achievement. You know, I'm a big sports fan too, and you know, one thing I've realized as I've gotten older and a little bit more aware of why I respond to this or that is that I love to see people working at the highest levels, no matter what that is. And when I look at the history of art, the paintings I always naturally gravitated towards or responded to tended to be those of the greatest expertise, the greatest mastery of any particular medium, whether it be painting or sculpture, architecture. So for me, I want to emulate the greatness of achievement. I want to emulate the understanding, complexity of learning that went into those masterworks.
Now, much of your career, you've dedicated to honing your craft and to that of others, actually. So how pivotal has education been to your career success and the others you've helped?
I think it was probably the most important thing. I got my undergraduate at a university and, found towards the end that I hadn't really gotten a lot better in the 4 years I was studying there. And so when I went to Florence to study in a curriculum that was really organized and clearly presented in an organized way, it made all the difference in the world in terms of developing my abilities as a painter, my understanding of the medium, my understanding of how to paint what was in front of me, how to see with extreme accuracy. When I came back from Florence, I realized that this education just didn't exist. So teaching for me wasn't really an option. I didn't feel like it was really an option. It was just sort of a need I felt to pass on what I was lucky enough to get. It was so easy and so accessible. And I thought, that I just saw a lot of other students puttering around in the dark the way I was when I was at the university. And I thought, it's so easy. I was given a flashlight. Maybe I can shine some light on the path for, a few other people. So it was just a natural progression for me.
Now, why did you start the Center for Academic Study and Naturalist Painting? You could have supported an existing initiative. You could have worked through academics, but instead you did this.
Yeah, I taught at a couple of universities and was, an adjunct professor at a couple of universities. And it just wasn't well received there. I think there's a way of doing business that they've always had in place. And the academic tradition in painting requires a slightly different foundational setup than the universities offer. I think, the system of grading and semesters and certain timelines that they give for projects in a university are not well equipped to give students the time they need to develop the skills that they need. So starting a school on my own seemed like the only option because it had to have an infrastructure or a way of organizing it that was more geared to student progress than it was to the machine of the university. And I had a lot of students coming to me and asking to study individually as well. So with those two things, it seemed just like the easiest thing to do to start my own school.
Well, you sort of touched on it, but what do you think are the deficiencies in current arts education culture that you've noticed?
Well, particularly for students that want to be more traditional painters, the deficiencies are that there's just a lack of good training for that skill base to help students develop that skill base. The natural thought for any young student is to get a degree, but there's, you know, no university in the world that teaches the traditional skills like the academies in the 19th century used to. And so students have to kind of look outside the box to find those skills again. And there's a couple of good academies and ateliers popping up that are well suited to teach those skills, pass those skills on. But I would say one of the deficiencies is just the way that we're brought up to think. You know, I always kind of relate it to, you know, kids in high school when they go to the guidance counselor and say, I want to be a lawyer. Their expectation is that, or a doctor, you know, the expectation is they're going to be in school for a really long time. And they know that at a young age. But the expectation for young art students is that they're already artists and they want to create immediately. And so the rigors of training aren't the expectation. And when faced with that, a lot of students don't have the innate discipline to buckle down and really study in the way that's needed to develop those skills. So I think it creates a system of mediocrity, I think. The expectation is very low and the requirements are very low. And production is put before training. And I think that's a little bit backwards. And unfortunately, art is sort of different than science or math or law or whatever. And I don't think it should be. I think that there's a great amount of discipline required to, especially again, making traditional art. I think there's a great amount of discipline required and a lot of good training required to work at the highest levels.
Do you find that traditional arts education also shortchanges people in the area of business training, how to be successful in a professional career and really run the side of the art practice that's necessary to be commercially viable?
I think it depends on the institution you study at and what they decide to focus on. I would say, you know, I went to university studying illustration, and so they did talk about the industry, the illustration industry, and give assignments relative to that industry, which would have been beneficial had I wanted to be an illustrator. I didn't want to be an illustrator. I just wanted to do traditional art. And the art program didn't have any tradition in it. It was all, or I guess it was a different tradition. It was the more modernist aesthetic tradition. And so that's why I was forced to study in illustration. So for that purpose, I think they did a pretty good job in helping prepare students for an illustration career. But for me, in terms of wanting to sell in galleries or find collectors or develop connoisseurship among collectors, there was no real training. And then, you know, studying in Florence, it was almost somewhat taboo to talk about the professional world or selling your work. It was almost kind of a dirty term because it sort of went against this clean, pure artistic mentality of just doing something from a pure standpoint. Money sort of taints that idea, and so it wasn't really talked about there, which was it made it difficult because I don't come from an art background. I came at this from nothing. I knew nothing about galleries or collectors or any of the world of art. So I made it difficult, but, you know, took a lot of years to kind of stumble my way and understand things professionally.
What has it done to your own arts practice to run this institute alongside trying to be a viable artist yourself?
Well, I think it's necessary for me. One of the things that I recognize in history is that greatness is never achieved alone. And so starting the school for me was in part very selfish. I knew I needed people that were trying for great things. I knew I needed people that were very good themselves to create a community around me where we all lifted each other up. That collective effort was far greater than I could make on my own, you know, painting in my own studio by myself. So I think that community is huge, and that's sort of the goal with one of the goals with the school is to continue to grow the community and help people get better and better and better, you know, obviously for them, but also for me selfishly, so that the better they get, the more they can help me get better, the more they can sort of point out my deficiencies and where I can improve. So. Yeah, that culture is hugely important for me.
But you recently planned to relaunch your art career with a solo show, and yet this didn't happen. So can you tell us why not?
Yeah, I had planned, I pulled out of galleries about 3 years ago, for the most part. I had a few little paintings hanging around in one or two galleries, but I wasn't really working for galleries anymore. One of the reasons for that is I just felt like I was doing mediocre work because I was afraid of money almost. I was painting, wanting to get a ton of stuff out there. I was working with a ton of galleries, turning out a lot of work, and none of it really great. Out of the fear of like, I needed money, I needed to sell, and I needed, you know, this many paintings so that this percentage of them would sell. And it really, I just felt like I was better than that. I felt like I could paint better than that. So I pulled out of galleries and then spent the next 2 years really slowing down and making more perfect work. Then I planned a one-man show with a gallery as a big sort of reintroduction to the art market. And I think it was in July. My show was supposed to be in August last year in 2015. And in July, I just felt like it wasn't the show I really wanted to put on. I wanted every single piece to be really fantastic. I didn't want any filler pieces. And I probably only had six or seven that were, I felt like were that strong. So I called the gallery and I said, let's postpone it for a year, which was really scary because that's another year of basically not selling. But I thought it was necessary to make the statement I wanted to make, which is I'm demanding more of myself, and here's the work to prove it. But then the gallery had some financial failings. A lot of their collectors were from Texas in the oil business, and when gas prices dropped dramatically, sales in the galleries dropped quite a bit, and the gallery just couldn't afford to put on the shows. So I was supposed to have the show August this year, and in March, I believe they called me and canceled it. So it was a bit frustrating, but it wasn't too bad. It wasn't a big hit because I had settled so well into this rhythm of just making work that I really believed in. So I knew there'd be more opportunities beyond that, even though that one had canceled at the last minute.
Well, I'm curious about a couple of things you said. So one is you used a term, I'm sure a lot of these people sort of say it, you know, under their breath, but filler art. And you said, I didn't want any filler art, and I only felt strongly about seven pieces or so. Is that a thing? I mean, you know, I think a lot of us don't know when you're used to, you know, looking at even the worst art, the rejects, from a Monet and going, well, that's a Monet. And, you know, I trot through museums and go, yeah, but it's not a good Monet.
Right.
And when I see that, you know, it gives a different impression, I think, to the public than when an artist says, no, if I were being honest, some of the art, it's filler art. Yeah. It isn't my best work. So So give us a little more perspective about that. And what's it like to produce that work that is less, you feel less strongly about? What do you do with it? And how do you feel about it? How does that, how do you position that in your own mind and so on?
That has become easier for me, especially as I pulled out of galleries. When I was in galleries, I felt like I had to sell it all like it was the most amazing thing, because you want, you're trying to tell the collector they're getting something of value, right? But for me, since I've pulled out, it's easier for me to distinguish between them. You know, I'll go out and do plein air sketches or sketches, still life sketches in the studio, portrait sketches that are maybe a little bit shorter period of time. That's just for learning or just to like take a break and do something fun, right? That is, has immediate gratification because in 3 hours you finish a really beautiful sketch. Those things are really beautiful, but they're learning tools, and they are, they're not these great compositions. They're not, to me, they're not paintings. They're not distinguishable as works of art. They are beautiful, and I want people to be able to appreciate them, so I sell them, but I distinguish that these are studies. And then there's works that I work on that are just pretty, right? This is a good, this is a nice landscape design. This is a very straightforward portrait of a pretty sitter, a pretty model, but not much design beyond that. And then there's works that I toil over the design on. I toil over the narrative, the composition, and I say, this is going to be a work of art. And those are the ones I settle in and spend months on, really making sure that every part of the canvas is balanced and really feeds the whole. And those are the works that I would say, these are works of art. These are the ones that are as masterful as I could make it. This is everything I could possibly do with my abilities at the moment. And there it is. And I want at some point for those to distinguish themselves as great works of art. And I think a lot about when I'm making them, the great works of art I want to emulate. And I try to put a lot of those qualities into those paintings. I really think, could this hang in the Met someday? If not, what are the areas where it's lacking? What are the things I could improve on to make that hang in the Met? And those are the works of art. Like if I have a one-man show, I want every single piece to be that, to have my full faith behind it, my absolute greatest effort. So that's how I distinguish it. And it, you know, makes it easier for me to balance it all in my mind. I do a lot of different works, but the purpose behind it is the distinguishing factor.
Got it. You also, you brought up the issue of choosing to stop working with galleries for a while, et cetera. But I want to know how you came to the decision that the galleries were the right move, and how did you weigh, in the first place, and how did you weigh things like apprenticeship, residencies, an atelier, all the various options that, you know, an artist can pick from in terms of a career direction?
Well, like I said, I, you know, studied illustrations, but I didn't want to be an illustrator. I knew I wanted to just make my own work. So the only real option that seemed viable was to sell in galleries. That was the epitome of making it as an artist, was to get in a good gallery and sell with other good artists. And I was coming at it with zero knowledge of anything. So when that was said to me, you got to get in a gallery, that's just where I went. That was the natural direction. So I was lucky enough to get in galleries really early. But I knew that I needed more skill. I knew that I wasn't doing the quality of work that I wanted. So that's when I went and studied at the Florence Academy and really developed those skills. But the goal then was still to try and make a name in the galleries and sell for a good amount of money and gain the respect of my peers and be in big shows. And yeah, it was just sort of, that felt like making it to me, you know, that was success. But when I got into it and was selling well and a part of that world, I realized that's not actually my definition of success. Selling well in galleries isn't the ultimate for me. The ultimate is doing really great work. And I saw so often that people could, you could make a very big name for yourself and gain a lot of respect for your success as an artist without great work. If you were a great marketer, you didn't have to be very good at painting, but you could be well respected because you were a great marketer. And people want what they've heard of. When they go to the gallery, they buy the stuff that they've heard of. And so marketing is a huge part of becoming financially successful, even more so, I would say, than good skill development. And the more I was in that world, the more I realized skill was what I wanted. Like I said at the beginning, I love to see human achievement. When I visit a museum, I'm overwhelmed by the human achievement aspect of what I'm viewing. I'm amazed that a person was able to do that. And I want to give that same experience to people who view my work. I want there to be a sort of awe when they see it. Somebody did this. Somebody took colored mud and made this, and that's amazing. So yeah, I did my priorities changed. I realized that success for me wasn't financially based. It was more achievement based. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does make sense. So I understand your focus. You sort of went down the path you did because you want to focus more on the creative side and not necessarily bow to what you know, which is a reality. We underscore this reality a lot. It's an important reality. That marketing is critical. You know, we don't do any good for ourselves burying our heads in the sand and pretending it isn't. If we're going to be commercially viable as artists, if we're going to make a living from our art, then it's critical to acknowledge that essentially the marketing is the work. That, you know, it is the work as far as the end user is concerned, because as you say, they buy what they know, they buy what has clout, what they're familiar with, what they think is a good investment or what. And there are exceptions. Right. There are people that are collectors that just get the technical aspects of it. But it's really, really a challenge to make a living just off people who sort of geek out over it versus and do it inductively. Right. It can be done, but few do. So it sure doesn't hurt Jackson Pollock. You know, it doesn't hurt Damien Hirst that there's a marketing perception of their work, perhaps far in excess of what the work really is. And what you've said is, well, the other options just go purely creative and to hell with it.
Well, I think you have to find a balance, but that balance is based on your priority list. So my balance is maybe a little bit offset to doing great work, but it absolutely cannot deny the need for marketing it. And there's two sides to that. One is it actually feeds from the creative, which is I'm doing work that is personally driven, but I'm doing it for other people. I'm doing it specifically to share it with other people. So I have to get it out there. I have, and particularly because that's the motivation. I want to share this with people. That's why I made it in the first place. I don't want to just make it and hide it in a closet. So marketing from that standpoint ties very well with it's not a dirty thing. It's part of that pure beauty because that's part of the motivation is to serve people, is to give this inspiration to people. And so you have to put it out there. And from the other standpoint, you do have to make a living. So some people prioritize the monetary return higher than the creative, and that's okay too, because that's their priority, right? My priorities are our craft and trying to do something lasting and do it at the highest levels and do it in a way that people will respond to very well. But you can't deny the other aspect of it, which is you got to put it out there and you have to find an audience. So I may just give a smaller percentage to that part of it and a larger percentage to the development of my craft, but it still has to be there for sure.
Well, this is a good moment for us to pivot. So as you know, the main thrust of the Thriving Artist podcast is the business side of art. So I want to turn now to the two sides of your business, namely the studio practice side and then the center. And so I have a burning question, which is, are you self-sustaining as a visual artist from your art, or does the center provide a good chunk of your income?
Yeah, it varies quite a bit. I think you know, art is a fickle, it's a fickle beast, right? It can go up and down, and there's no sort of rhyme or reason for it. Things can sell really well for a little while and then go quiet for a bit, and then pick up again. And that's the way it's been for me. So in terms of art sales, it's kind of a tough thing to predict. And so in the times where it's a little bit leaner, yeah, definitely teaching is helps me get through financially. But the art definitely sustains what I'm doing. I mean, it's definitely the foundation for keeping me going. Sometimes it's, you know, I guess I just have to be really good at budgeting. You know, whenever I have a big windfall, I have to be more careful and stretch it out, knowing that potentially there could be a lean moment in a few months. So you just have to be clever with how you manage your funds and manage your business and understand that there are ups and downs to it. And the longer I've been in it, the better I've gotten at that.
I imagine that you also need to budget for projects, you know, even if it's just as simple as materials, framing and transportation. And you need to, you probably have a trick or two for projecting what your costs and your return are going to be.
Yeah, just trial and error. I've kind of figured out, you know, how much framing costs will be, shipping costs. You factor that into everything. You know, also factor that into the sales price. And if you're selling on your own versus selling in a gallery and the percentage that the galleries take, it all goes to factoring in and budgeting and working out. You know, art is a really expensive profession. It's the material costs and shipping, and it's pretty expensive. But and so you have to learn how to be good at balancing your budget and projecting some of those costs, so that you can do it properly. You never want to cut corners when you're trying to be professional. You always want to use the best materials and frame it the best and ship it well so it doesn't get damaged. You have to be good at balancing your budget.
Well, I want to, and I'll mention that, you know, in the Business Accelerator Program at the Clark Healings Fund, that's one of the things that we help artists focus on is the financial side of the art business, how to plan projects. Some projects for say an installation artist or when you're doing a major residency, they can really be, as you say, quite costly. I think people have no idea. And the importance of pivotal funding, you know, some of the people that go through our fellowship program, they if they have a solid project proposal at the end and a clear business plan for how this will impact their career, et cetera, then in many cases we will fund aspects of those projects, like, you know, building a multi-thousand dollar apparatus or getting the art across a continent, et cetera. But I think it's very, I think a lot of artists are probably nodding their heads right now. You know, it costs more than you think. So the budgeting thing is really near and dear to our hearts, and the financial management.
Yeah, I think that's definitely isn't discussed a lot in educational, from an educational standpoint. Those costs are not really discussed and how to manage those costs and prepare for it. What you're not told is that as an artist, you're a small business owner. And you're in charge. You're the boss, and you have to manage that like any other small business would be managed. And so you have to keep your books organized, and you have to plan for big expenses, and you have to plan for investing in those big projects. So I think what the Clark Healings Fund is doing is brilliant because it's such a void in education that needs to be filled in helping people understand, you know, because creative people aren't necessarily innately prepared for that side of it. But it's a sort of make or break aspect to our profession, that if you buckle down and have the discipline to learn it and manage it, you could be very successful. And if you don't, you could fail very quickly because it is an expensive thing to be an artist.
That's sort of what I was pointing at earlier when I was asking you about the lapses in art education, because as you say, you know, the gap is, it's kind of dirty to talk about the money. So not only do you not talk about making money, you don't necessarily talk about cost projection, how to budget your finances and plan a project. And yet it's kind of a crime, because what happens to you when you get out, when you're thrust out into the commercial market as an artist? Suddenly, that's exactly what you have to do. You're planning projects, projecting costs, setting your price. One of the biggest questions our fellows bring up is, how do I strategically do my pricing in a way that is sustainable? You know, I don't leave money on the table, but I cover my costs, and I make this, I leave a little room that I can take on new adventurous directions in the future, instead of having to be just in an art factory producing something to sell at, you know, some really bottom of market price. It's almost criminal this stuff isn't part of the core educational curriculum, you know. And so I'm not trying to oversell what we do in the accelerator program, but that's where we're filling the gap. We just step in and we say, look, this is the grad school of of the grad school, and so you need this stuff. I want to ask you about the center, though. You built an art career from the ground up, and I want to know what were the challenges and what went into doing that, and how does that affect how you deliver education to your center?
I'm very aware of how naive I was. I'm astounded at how naive I was coming up through the ranks. And so I think it motivates me all the more to give as much as I possibly can in terms of information to the students, not just in terms of development of skills, but also helping open their eyes to the realities of this as a business, and helping them prepare to not only fulfill their personal artistic vision, but be successful in fulfilling that vision. How do you balance this? How do you create a sustaining business for you, so that when you leave here, you can continue on? Because, you know, getting a great education and developing great skill, I've seen it a lot of times with a lot of people I studied with. They go through those rigors and they develop these great skills, and then they end up working as a hotel bellhop or something, because they can't afford to make paintings. Or even more often, they afford to make paintings, but they never afford to make the great paintings that they want to make, because they're sort of stuck doing the small, simple, decorative, pretty things that they know will sell. And the great projects that are so close to their heart are left to the wayside because they're too expensive to make. So for me, all of that is part of the daily conversation. You know, obviously we focus more on developing skills in our day-to-day routine, but we're constantly, as a group, going to Portrait Society of America or plein air conventions, meeting professional artists, meeting with galleries, collectors, and getting these students integrated into that professional world.
I also want to say, you know, I want to ask, how do your workshops fit into your overall business plan if your intention is to ensure that your own art career is sustainable? I mean, I think the average person would look in from the outside and say, you know, pick one thing, do it well, either bake cookies or sell bananas, but don't try to do both.
Yeah, and not even just bake cookies, but bake chocolate chip cookies with these particular ingredients, and I think that's a very common theme that will help people create success, is to do one thing. If I'm the guy that paints red Levi's on pretty girls standing in alleyways in New York, the more specific I can be with the thing that I do, the easier it is to brand what I do, and the faster my success will be, the faster I'll find an audience, because that branding is so strong. It's one of the things that I've tried to completely avoid, which is, you know, I'm very clear with my students, this may not be the best idea from a business standpoint, but I want the freedom to do whatever I want. And so my road is going to be longer. The common tie, the branding of my work will probably take much, much longer to be recognizable than it would be if I did the pretty girls in red jeans in New York alleyways, because I do landscape and still life and figure and nudes and figures outdoors and all of it. So yeah, I think that's a difficult thing, and people want to say this guy does this, but I never wanted that. I'm trying to avoid that at all costs so I can retain that freedom. And teaching is like I said, is an absolute necessity to not only pass on knowledge, but to be a part of the community that helps me get better. So I don't mind if people say, why don't you just focus on this? I'm hyper-focused. It may be on various things, but they're all towards the same goal of doing great work and seeing others do great work as well. So I'm not bothered by it. I'm very clear in my mind of what I'm trying to achieve. And so that sort of criticism wouldn't bother me.
So you're very cognizant of the need for branding, and obviously emphasize it. But you also are stating, you're sort of calling us out and saying, you know, yeah, but there's also what your soul is telling you to do and what you want. And these are a tension. Neither one can perfectly trump the other. You can do what you want and make and starve to death. You can brand yourself and market yourself and end up not being happy. You cannot afford to just go to the extreme on either one. So I like that.
Yeah, I think that you find happiness because you're fulfilling your priorities. If I choose to brand a little bit less, I know in the long run, again, there will be a common thread and the brand will be a little bit more recognizable. So I've invested in the long game. And so the early leanness that might exist financially, I'm satisfied that I did it on purpose. I'm satisfied that it was a conscious decision to do so. So there's happiness in that anyways. And I think that's going to be personal for the individual. Some people want financial success a lot earlier on. So their efforts to brand themselves early are more focused in, and that's totally fine. I think everybody just has to say, here's my priorities, and then really fight for those and stay true to those. And then, you know, good or bad on either side, know that it was a conscious choice and you're fulfilling your grander vision for yourself. And I think you'll be fine. I think there's solace in that, you know.
I do know what you mean. Well, let me ask you this. So let's focus for just a second on the center itself in terms of its marketing, because we've talked quite a bit about how it sort of interacts with you as an artist or interferes or doesn't interfere. But how does the center find clients, and how do you advertise or promote so that you have a steady stream or a pipeline of clients coming to you for education?
We are an Art Renewal approved school, so we're featured on the Art Renewal Atelier list. A lot of people find us through that. I think they get, millions of hits a year. So a lot of people find us through that resource, you know, because it's particularly geared towards people who are looking for traditional art and traditional art instruction. So that's been a big thing for us. We have a strong social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and are able to show what we're doing on a daily basis with our curriculum, student work, upcoming events, things like that. We have a newsletter that people can sign up for. We have workshop participants, so we have a pretty good email list that we can send. And then just being a part of the community and being involved with other artists, professionals, students. We have open drawing sessions for the public 3 nights a week that helps bring in people and help people be a little bit more aware of what we're doing. We have a little gallery up front that brings in collectors from time to time to look around and buy work or meet the artists. So there's a number of things. We bring in other people once a year from different schools to teach, to sort of broaden our audience with workshop participants. So there's a number of things we're trying to do. We're trying to move the school to Paris, which would be huge. We're just going through that process now where we've been approved as a nonprofit and starting to approach potential donors to help us move the school to Paris.
Well, depending on the outcome of the upcoming election, a lot of your students might be going with you. It just depends.
Right.
So we hear. That's the rumor floating around. I don't know how true that is, but
right.
We'll see. people are true. Well, I'm going to pause for a minute just to address our audience and say that the Clark Hewlings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. And please know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. So share this commitment with us now at clarkhewlingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkhewlingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, I want to ask, what is the biggest impediment to your studio practice, Ryan, and how do you overcome the barriers that are there for you?
That's a good question. I don't feel as many barriers as I used to. I used to use money as one of my excuses, you know, for not doing bigger projects or for spending so long on projects. I try not to make any of those excuses anymore. I have a list of projects on a whiteboard next to my easel. And there's probably, I tried to count them last night and then I lost count. But it's somewhere around 40 or 50 projects. And these are the ones that I really believe in. These are like edited down from all my ideas. These are the best. And I have a list of ones that are nearly completed, ones that are started but far from finished, and then ideas I haven't even started yet. And so I just prioritize that way and say these are the most significant. If I'm going to spend my time on anything, it's only on something that has to exist. A lot of the barriers I felt earlier on aren't there anymore. I have 5 kids, so I'm not only balancing teaching and running a school and organizing workshops and, painting on my own as well, but I also coach my son's basketball team and have to go to soccer games and be home for dinner and all of that other stuff. So, but the older I get, the better I get at balancing all of those elements, and the less confined I feel because I've stopped making excuses.
Wow. I don't think that there are any artists who don't understand what you're talking about. And if it's not money or time, it's some other excuse about what holds us back. And it's funny that you interpreted it this way. You know, when I said barriers, you could have talked about anything. You could have simply said, well, you know, my kids are the barrier, or, you know, I don't have enough money for art supplies or something. But you just went right to, well, by barrier, what you really mean, Daniel, is excuse. I thought that was pretty profound. Talk to me for a second. We talked earlier about marketing, but do you market your work? And if so, how do you do it?
Yeah, I try to keep my website pretty well up to date. I have a lot of resources on there, from like a bookshelf of helpful books to a couple of YouTube videos. And I just came out with my first how-to video. And then, you know, I have like studio sales each month where I'll have a few items for sale. And then, you know, social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you know, whenever I finish something or I have something in progress, I'll post it on social media to let people know about it. And that's been enough for me. You know, that sustains me. That gives me the sales I need and the exposure I feel like I need to share the work. Obviously, I'd like to grow that in the future. And, you know, I'm sort of collecting a lot of work most of the major work in my studio, thinking at some point I'll approach a gallery maybe in 2 or 3 years and really have a solid one-man show. But I'm really not concerned about it. I'm doing well enough where I'm not highly concerned about it. You know what I'm saying? I'm able to pay my bills and do what I need to do. And I don't feel a huge pinch to do too much more than I'm doing at the moment, focused on really trying to raise funds to move to Paris and get the school going there. But in terms of my personal work, I'm in a really good place where I feel like I'm doing my best work. And I've found a pretty good balance. I'm pushing myself in the areas I really want to push myself. And I feel like I watched a short interview with Steve Martin, and they asked him, you know, what advice do you give young people who want to make it show business? And he says, it's the advice I give to everyone is be so good that they can't ignore you. And that's what I'm focused on at the moment, is I think it'll take care of itself if the work is so good that it can't be ignored. And that's, you know, that'll prove itself in the next decade or so, if that's true. But I'm kind of testing that theory at the moment.
Well, you know, I think there are, most artists really want that. I think a lot of artists, what they do is rely purely on their gallery representation to market their work. They sort of, you know, we'll often talk with artists and they'll say, we'll say, do you have a mailing list? And they'll say, well, my gallery does. And do you interact with people on Facebook? Well, I post something once in a while, but my gallery has a Facebook page. And it goes on and on to the point where you're sort of at the mercy, you're sort of almost like a factory. You're making art and they've got the marketing arm, but you're limited by that arm, no matter how good it is. You're sort of limited in terms of your ability to directly impact an audience with the larger story. So I wonder what your future will be like, you know, how you see yourself in, say, 6 or 8 years in regard to your personal art. You know, are you going to rely solely on the gallery? Are you going to, you know, you do frequent blog posts, you have a strong Facebook and Twitter following. So do you feel that your marketing savvy is enough that when the moment feels right, you're going to take on marketing, I guess, in a broader way? Is that something you're going to do?
I wouldn't necessarily use the term marketing savvy in the same context with me. I think the marketing that I want to do, and I think every artist should think about, is maybe you're not out, you know, boldly self-promoting all the time, but if you can take control of the perception to a degree of what people, how people see your work and what they think of your work by just talking about it, you can have you know, a blog, which is free. That's the great thing about social media, is it's free advertising. So if you can develop a social media presence, it's not artificial. It's a very natural form of marketing, because what it allows you to do is just share your perspective on your work. Here's my work, and here's a little blurb about it. Here's what I was thinking when I made it, and here's what I'm going through. And you're sharing that with people. It's very honest and direct, and it gives them a sort of narrative behind your efforts as an artist. And I think a lot of people are interested in that. They're genuinely interested. And if they can understand that, then self-promotion doesn't feel as icky, you know? So my hope is that I can just continue a sort of honest dialogue with my collectors, an honest dialogue with people who follow me on social media, so that they can understand what I'm doing, what I'm trying to do. And that presence has just naturally grown as a result of it. So again, we make these things for other people. So it's a natural extension of creating the art to also create the dialogue about the art when you're talking about it on social media.
Well, and of course, you pointed out earlier that part of marketing is the branding side. Can you speak for just a minute about how your particular art is the chocolate chip cookie? You know, it's not just painting in a certain genre, but what is your brand?
That's a good question. Again, I feel like I'm in the long game. I feel like my brand is going to be a little bit more apparent over time. There'll be a common thread that'll be more distinguishable in retrospect rather than immediately. And so I guess I'm sort of playing that my brand is a non-brand. It's that I'm capable of doing really good landscapes and really good portraits and really good figures and combining a lot of these genres into more significant pieces. That's what I'm hoping to do. And so my brand will be that he's capable, that he's wide ranging, that he has a larger focus and an ability to do it all well. And again, this is where I may fail in marketing to some degree, that I'm not willing to settle for a thing. And so my investment may be a little bit longer, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with the fact that it may be a little bit less distinguishable. I did that on purpose to allow for more freedom.
Yes, I think that makes sense. And I think, you know, certainly it probably insulates you, I would guess, from the art market pigeonholing you. You know, you're sort of saying my brand is a non-brand. So if there's genre bias, is this your way of evading it? Or does genre bias not really come into your thinking?
No, it doesn't really come to my thinking. I'm very self-motivated in the projects I have. So, I've tried to fit before. In years past, I've tried to fit in this or that, or I see that the Western art market is very strong. So I try to do a Western painting, but my heart's just not in it. But I think it'll sell, so I did it anyway. And, you know, it ends up being a bit trite. And you know, as I've grown, I've said, if I make this choice over this choice, if I prioritize this over that, what am I gaining and what am I giving up? And one of the things I felt like I was giving up is more immediate success, financial success, by avoiding a particular brand, but gaining freedom to pursue any subject matter I felt needed to be pursued at that moment. And so it's not necessarily advice I would give to anyone else unless they had similar priorities. But I think any young artist has to decide what absolutely is the most important for them and then make it their own priority list. Understanding that definitely marketing and self-promotion has to be a part of it in order for you to survive as an artist, to continue working. But definitely having a distinct priority list that says this I absolutely have to have and this maybe could take a back seat. And for me, the branding has to be in the long run game. Can't be an immediate thing, because I've had galleries tell me what they expect. I've had galleries get upset because I didn't fulfill their expectations. I've had articles in magazines that said he's a landscape artist. And the moment I read that, I start painting more figures, because I'm not just a landscape artist. Do you know what I'm saying? I love the landscape and I love the figure, and I want people to feel that love in whatever work they see. So that's what I chose. I chose freedom over a particular brand.
It's funny, the first business I ever ran when I was a younger man was a landscaping company, and I used to tell people I was a landscape artist.
Yeah.
And I'll install hedges. I will. I'll even put up a fence around them. You'll have a beautiful scene like something out of a painting. So, yeah, a lot of fun. Well, it sounds like you've had to deal, I mean, if we put it a certain way, you've had to deal, whether you frame it as disapproval or whatever, you have to deal with rejection a little bit. Is there a secret to being mentally tough enough to deal with rejection and even to sort of take on an industry that is so rife with competition and with hierarchy?
It takes a lot of courage and a lot of confidence. I think you have to have more confidence than is sometimes good for you. You have to be a little bit arrogant in a good way. The kind of arrogance that's still humble enough to be teachable. But the kind of arrogance that assumes you can do it, you know, you have to be willing to just dive in and just do it. Totally, totally be self-aware enough to say, these are my absolute goals, and I'm not going to let anything else stand in the way. If I have to get my education to do it, there's no excuses. I'm going to go get my education. If I have to move to Florence and spend 3 or 4 years studying, I'm going to do that because that's my goal. If I'm going to do grand paintings and really complex multi-figure work, then that's where my heart is. I'm going to do it. And no matter what, that has to be the attitude, I think. Whether you get good or bad reviews, whether you have good or bad experiences with galleries, you have to be very stubborn and very confident in who you are, what you want to achieve, and then make no excuses and just stick with it. Because I think it comes with being an artist that we're all probably somewhat bipolar. We have days where we feel amazing. We just did the most amazing painting, and the next morning we hate everything we've ever done. And through that kind of excitement and disappointment, you have to have something deeper that keeps you going, so that deeper motivation and confidence that says I can do this no matter what I can and no matter what I will.
Yeah, so you're describing a quality that I've actually found in a lot of working artists who the trajectory looks really positive, which is kind of an obstinate persistence. It can come off as arrogance if you don't know what they have to deal with, but it isn't. It's like a bulldog that latches on and isn't going to let go.
Right, right. Yeah, I think, again, and it comes with being a small business owner, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if you're running a pizza shop or being an artist, you have to stick with it. You have to be willing to invest the time and the energy and make it work. If that's what you really want to see happen, you have to stick with it until you accomplish it.
Well, I want to wind down with just a couple of fun questions. If you weren't an artist, what would you be?
Well, originally I wanted to be an NBA star, but I didn't practice hard enough to be an NBA star. And then I wanted to be a singer, like a singer in a rock and roll band, but I don't have a good voice. So artist is sort of was the thing that I could do. And if for some reason I couldn't paint, I think I would probably try to write. I'd be a writer.
Well, so, you know, it's not as glamorous a path that you chose. There aren't, if you're old enough to remember trading cards, no one's ever made artist trading cards, you know, like,
right.
I'll trade you a Van Gogh for a Monet,
right.
But,
right.
But, you know, it is a creative and passionate line of work. So a couple more questions. If you could do one thing differently, do it over, do it differently from when you started to where you are now, what would that be?
I think I would try to be a little bit more disciplined early on. I think I would have a lot more. I would try to talk my younger self into not being so afraid of money, into saying that these things are more important than the money. If you do it well, if you take your time to do it well, instead of doing it quickly and filling the galleries with 12 paintings, if you gave them one great painting instead of 12 mediocre paintings, you'd probably find success faster than if you did the 12 mediocre paintings. I feel like I spent a lot of years creating a perception of mediocrity for me and my work by just trying to do a lot of it. And if I could go back and give myself a lecture, it would be slow down and just work on the greatest of your ideas. And things will be better much faster as a result. And they have been for me since I made that decision.
Well, that's an interesting tension because, you know, the 10,000 hours rule, you have to make a lot of work to really build up enough definition of your brand and build up the skill set. And yet there's a tension between that and building something that's good, that matches your vision, perhaps.
I'm actually reading a book right now that clarifies the 10,000 hour rule. It's called Peak, the New Science of Expertise, Secrets to the New Science of Expertise. And it clarifies the 10,000 hour rule. It says that it's not just about 10,000 hours. It's about two very distinct aspects of the 10,000 hours. One is being a very focused effort, a very clear effort towards accomplishing something, instead of just, you know, if I pick up a guitar and I just play for an hour a day, just playing around, versus really working through my progressions and working on a very focused, trying to practice very focused in a very focused way. And then also practicing under really great guidance from a great teacher. He says, if you do those two things, the 10,000 hour rule makes sense. But it's not just about the 10,000 hours. I think artists think you just got to get miles on your brush, which is partly true. But if you get very focused and determined miles on your brush with great guidance, you'll get much better, much faster. And that 10,000 hours is going to turn into mastery rather than just efficiency, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I think some artists have notches on their brush. It depends on what you've had to go through, how hard the journey's been. All right, so last question. We're going to reverse the question we asked. Instead of going back to the past to change something, we're going to say, fast forward to now, and you could have one superpower or technology to do something that you're just not currently able to do, what would you wish for? What would you seize if given the option?
I would love to be able to have a conversation, a group conversation with some of the masters. But I actually think that that is possible. I think that I really just need to spend more time in museums. But it's one of the things that currently doesn't exist in any art education is copying for the masters. And it's one thing why, you know, one of the reasons I want to move to Paris is to add that back to the curriculum, both for the students and for myself. I think that conversation with the masters is integral to understanding how they solved certain problems. You know, as painters, we're dealing with parameters of oil paint, and the masters weren't hiding secrets on their canvas. They, you know, they weren't like painting these Da Vinci codes of painting. They put solutions down, and what we're seeing is the very best solutions ever figured out by master painters. Here's how to explain a hand. Here's how you paint a portrait. I would just love to have a greater conversation with the masters and understand some of those solutions so I could better integrate some of them into my own work. But I don't think you need a superpower to do that. I think you just have to spend the time with them and, you know, like you would with a figure drawing. If you really want to understand the figure, you spend time observing and drawing from the figure, from life. And spending time in museums, I think, is one thing that will help me get to the next level. But again, I don't think that it requires a superpower. But if I had a superpower, I would go back in time and actually sit them down and talk to them, pick their minds.
You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on the Center for Academic Study and Naturalist Painting, visit cas-utah.com. For more information on Ryan Brown, visit ryansbrown.com. And for more information on the Clark Hulings Fund and our Business Accelerator Program, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Ryan. It's been really great having you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.